with any judge. I never asked their personal opinion on the subject of abortion. Not to my recollection have I ever sat down with her. What I have done is understand the type of person she is and the type of judge she will be.
That's President George W. Bush in the Rose Garden this morning in a rare news conference. He's talking there in that cut about Harriet Meyer, his latest nomination to the Supreme Court, filling the nomination of retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Phyllis Schlafly joins us here for the next few minutes. We're going to be talking about Harriet Meyer's and that vacancy and her hopes and her thoughts, her reaction to all of it as well. She's president of Eagle Forum. In just a few minutes, Jan LaRue, chief counsel for Concerned Women for America, will also be our guest on the same subject. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Phyllis Schlafly is a regular guest, and she's author of several books, including The Supremacists. Phyllis, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Pastor Todd. Always good to join you.
Phyllis, your reaction to the nomination of Harriet Meyers?
Extreme disappointment. President Bush led us to believe that he would appoint somebody in the mold of Scalia or Thomas, and she certainly is not that. We're just terribly disappointed. I'm afraid she sounds like a female suitor. She doesn't have any children. She doesn't have any paper trail that we can find out what she believes in. She hasn't written. The job of a Supreme Court justice is to write opinions, and we'd like to know what she's going to write based on what she has written. And we don't know that. So we're taking a shot in the dark.
So how do you explain this? The last time we talked about it, maybe a week ago, you said that you really expected the president and wanted the president to keep his promise to kind of follow in the Scalia-Thomas mold for the Supreme Court. And yet you say now that Harriet Meyers is not that, as far as we can tell. How do you explain the president's action here?
Well, I'm not a mind reader, so I don't know. The front page of the New York Times today said basically he didn't want to fight. He isn't a fighter. It may be that he was intimidated by all the noise created by the left, who are demanding that he appoint somebody who was pleasing to them. And as a matter of fact, I am really concerned that the minority leader in the Senate said he recommended her. Well, that doesn't give us a good feeling at all, Harry Reid.
What about the life issue? Do we know anything about Harriet Meyer's record on life issues?
No, we really don't. And again, I find it offensive, really, that they have put out that what we have to go on is she donated to a pro-life cause. But that isn't really true. She bought a ticket to an annual event that all the politicians go to so they'll be introduced when they're running for office. And that's not the same as supporting a pro-life cause. So we don't know, and Bush said, can you believe Bush said he'd never discussed abortion with her? She's been one of his closest associates. She got the job because she's a Bush crony. Nobody could deny that. There's no way she would have been picked if she were not a personal friend and supporter of Bush, who thinks Bush is, somebody quoted her saying she thinks he's the smartest man she ever met. Well, that's kind of ridiculous. Though also kind of ludicrous when Bush said she was the most qualified person in the country for this post, for this position.
All right, so I want to come back to that comment that he made in the Rose Garden this morning when he was asked point blank about the abortion issue, and he said, we just haven't talked about it. It hasn't come up. What does that tell you about the priorities for the court beyond the nomination of John Roberts, who seemed to be pretty firmly pro-life?
It tells us that he didn't do what we expected him to do. If he made up his mind he's going to pick a woman, then we were entitled to have somebody who was the opposite of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And there's no way you can say she is that. She's as far as we can tell, she's a corporate attorney who represented Microsoft, and I don't know that she has any views one way or the other. We don't know. Maybe it's going to turn out fine, but we don't know.
All right, then let's talk about what you expect to happen in the next couple of weeks when it comes down to the Senate Judiciary Committee's chance to look her over, to pass her out if possible, and then to come before the entire Senate. What do you think her prospects are?
Well, they're probably pretty good. They're probably the Republicans will vote for anybody Bush puts up there, and the Democrats, I guess, are divided. Senator Reid, you know, voted against Roberts, and now he says he's for Harriet Myers. So I guess her chances of being confirmed are very good. And it's unlikely she'll fall on her face during the interrogation. Roberts endured 20 hours of questioning, and he handled them very skillfully, and she probably can do the same thing without telling us anything.
Phyllis Lafley is our guest, president of Eagle Forum. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We are broadcasting live from Grace Lutheran Church in McPherson, Kansas, on day one of our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour. Do you know of anybody close to her that might know her views on abortion? Is there any way of finding these things out?
Well, people have been, they've been running around trying to get people who know her. She apparently has made some motions when she was active in the Bar Association. But these people are saying they really don't know what her views are. She's very close-mouthed. She's apparently, just keeps her own counsel. And they really are not able to tell her. Now, apparently some people are saying they're sure she's pro-life or Bush wouldn't have picked her. So I honestly don't know. I think it's just a disappointment. We wanted, and if we were going to pick a woman, there are a number of women out there who have very fine records, and they're on record as being for the Constitution and would decide properly on the pro-life issues. But she doesn't have that kind of record, and we don't know. And unfortunately, our history of picking stealth candidates is pretty bad. When we pick somebody, we don't know what they're going to do. The tremendous pressure on the court is to move left. And as many of them have moved left, like Souter and like Kennedy and like O'Connor.
Do you think this represents a shift? I was talking to somebody earlier, Phyllis, about an apparent, what it appeared to be, a difference between Term 1, George W. Bush, Term 2, George W. Bush. Term 1, it's John Ashcroft for Attorney General. Term 2, it's Alberto Gonzalez. Now, there's a difference there. Term 1, we have a president who, in more ways than one, goes to the mat over life issues, and in term two, when he has these once-in-a-lifetime opportunities to fill two vacancies, at least his second one doesn't seem to have any pro-life pedigree.
Yes, I think that's a fair comment. That is right, and you don't know. He's in Washington, and they're very much influenced by the media down there, influenced by the left that sounds off all the time, says he has to pick a moderate, said they had to pick somebody like O'Connor. I wish somebody would show me how she's any better than O'Connor. We were hoping that the president would move the court in the direction of sticking by the Constitution. And we have no confidence that Harriet is going to do this.
Finally then, Phyllis, are we going to end up, you think, in about the next 2 months, with yet another 6-3 pro-Roe court, with having two vacancies having come and gone with really nothing changed?
That would be sad, wouldn't it? I think that would destroy the faith of all the people who worked and voted for George Bush because we expected him to change the court. The Democrats and the liberals are so eager to keep the court the way it is. In fact, Nancy Pelosi famously said, when the Supreme Court issues a decision, it's almost as if God has spoken. Now, Pastor Todd, I know that God did not write these Supreme Court decisions, but the liberals are determined to keep the court the way it is because that's the only way they can win. And we were counting on George Bush to move it in the direction of respect for the Constitution. And if we wake up and find that it's just simply the way it has been, I think this will be reflected in the way people vote at the polls in the congressional election and in the next presidential election.
Did I mention that
Harriet doesn't have any children, and I'm a dubious about having somebody on the court who doesn't have children, like Souter, because I just think you need children to know what life is all about.
I think I'd agree there, too. It's a chapter that's unwritten without them as well. EagleForum.org is the website address for Eagle Forum. Phyllis Schlafly is the president.
And it does show, this nomination does show the importance of my book, The Supremacist, because Congress has got its duty to put the limits on the court so they don't commit some more of this mischief that they've been committing in the past.
And you can find Phyllis's book, The Supremacists, at eagleforum.org. Phyllis Schlafly, as usual, thank you for being our guest.
Have a good evening.
And you as well. Jan LaRue joins us for the next few minutes of the program. We're going to spend some time with her talking about the same subject. She's Chief Counsel for Concerned Women for America based in Washington, D.C. Jan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
What about your reaction to Harriet Meyer's nomination?
Well, we issued a press release yesterday saying that we will have to wait and see. We give the benefit of the doubt to the president because he has picked some wonderful people to be on the federal courts, including John Roberts. But in this particular case, we need some record of some kind in writings, in speeches, that will show that Harriet Myers, in fact, has a clear philosophy of judicial restraint and relying on the written text of the Constitution.
Jan, something struck me. I was watching that Rose Garden press conference this morning. And what struck me was when the questions were specific about Harriet Meyers and her views, about what the president knew of her views that went into his decision, several times, not every time, but several times, he responded in essence and sometimes specifically, "I know her heart."
Mm-hmm.
What is he saying when he says, look, you want to know the specifics, you want to know why I made my decision, I know her heart?
Well, you know, that may be very true, but the rest of us, in order to retain any credibility when it comes to, endorsing a particular candidate, need to know more than that. We are privy to her heart. And, this is not going to hold up when, you know, she's confronted with questions by the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Well, the president knows my heart.
Okay, so let's get to the Judiciary Committee. If we could just step forward in time a little bit, Jan. When Roberts went through his many hours of examination by that Senate committee, he was asked in more than one way repeatedly to explain his views on Roe, to explain his views on abortion, everything, on the life issues. And he repeatedly said, look, most of this is probably going to be the subject of a case I might hear as a justice, and so I'm not going to comment on those things. And if I remember in conversations with many, they said, look, that's how he should be answering. Could we be looking in Meyer's confirmation hearings at this time now the Republicans on that committee saying, Mrs. Meyers, what are your thoughts on abortion? Now they're asking her the questions they want to know where she comes from on this issue.
Whether it's asked by Democrats or Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee is still inappropriate questioning. No judge should respond to questions regarding issues or cases that he or she may have to decide when on the court. The appropriate questioning goes to opinions, if the person is a judge and has any writings, speeches that the person has made. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg has acknowledged that. And so, to inquire into what is your position on abortion, when in fact you've got a case right now on the court's docket and potentially the court reviewing the congressional ban on partial birth abortion coming before the court.
Do you think the president was surprised by the criticism that came from social conservatives to the Meyer nomination?
Well, he's obviously seeing the need to come out and defend her even more, and we're getting all kinds of emails and articles forward to us, in an attempt to do that. I really think that it's too bad that the president has put himself in the position of having to, in effect, answer that question, have you stopped beating your wife? He should have known that any reporter worth his or her salt would do what the reporter did today in the Rose Garden. And that is to say, when you look across the United States, did you pick the most qualified person to sit on the Supreme Court? He said yes. If he'd have said no, he'd have been at a loss to say then what, to defend why he picked her. By saying yes, everybody thinks to him or herself, that just isn't true.
But he said yes in a very particular way, Jan. If I remember correctly, he said, yes, I wouldn't have nominated her if I didn't think she was the most qualified, which is kind of going round in a circle.
No,
you know what I mean?
That's him saying yes, that she is that most qualified person, or he wouldn't have picked her. Now, if he truly believes that, it's one thing, but it just isn't believable for most of the people who are aware of all the many very qualified people to be nominated to the Supreme Court.
Who, I don't know if I want you to speculate, who should he have nominated? If he was going to put a woman on the court to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, who should he have nominated?
First of all, Concerned Women for America doesn't think that whether it's sex, race, or ethnicity, that should be the first criterion for consideration. It should be the most qualified person. If that happens to be a woman or a black or a Hispanic, that's perfectly acceptable with us. But we have suggested both to the president and to the public several names that we believe are people that are highly qualified to go to the Supreme Court. The president was aware of them. He has considered them in the past. They were circulated in the media as being on a short list. And while Harriet Meyer's name was there, we really considered that, surely it's there. The president will look at it because, he knows her, he works with her, but that doesn't mean she's the most qualified person for the position. And nothing I'm saying should be construed as opposition to her. We haven't done that. I doubt there's anything we'd learn about her that would cause us to oppose her. What I'm saying is we are not satisfied that there is a sufficient enough record for us to at this point endorse her.
Jan LaRue is chief counsel for Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. Their website address is cwfa.org, cwfa.org. And we hope to have Kansas Senator Sam Brown back tomorrow on Issues Etc. to discuss the Myers nomination as well. Jan, thank you again for being our guest.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Bye-bye.
Well, we're broadcasting from Kansas, but back in St. Louis, coming up in just a few weeks, on Friday, November the 11th, there will be the premier bioethics conference of the year, including many Issues Etc. regular guests, among them Wesley Smith, as one of the keynote speakers, at the Image of God Bioethics Conference in St. Louis, November the 11th, on Friday. We'll be broadcasting live from that bioethics conference. For more information on this premier bioethics conference, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the logo of the Image of God Bioethics Conference, issuesetc.org. All right, for the remainder of the hour, what do we got? A few minutes going into this next break. Let's talk about our sermon review. Dr. Larry Rast is a regular guest on the program. He is a member of the faculty at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. As a member of the faculty there, they have chapel every day and they preach sermons. Well, we've got a hold of one of his sermons, this one on Matthew 24 on the abomination that makes desolation. And we're going to be reviewing this sermon here in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. How do we review our sermons? All right. We review our sermons with a three-part diagnostic. You listen to the sermon. This is how it's done. It's very simple. And you're listening for whether or not you're hearing a Christ-centered, cross-focused sermon. Number one, as you listen to the sermon, just keep a running tally. How often do you hear Jesus mentioned? Okay, this is simple. Just listen for the name Jesus and just keep a little, like, on your notepad. One, two, three, four. Make it cross off. There you got five. A running tally of how often you hear Jesus mentioned. Why do you do this? This is the first part of the diagnostic. If Jesus isn't mentioned in the sermon wasn't about him. It was about something else or someone else. Second part of the diagnostic, if Jesus is mentioned and Jesus is, you hear his name clearly mentioned, not God, not the Almighty, not Lord, but Jesus. If he is mentioned, then ask yourself this second question. It's the second part of the diagnostic. Is Jesus the subject of the verbs? This just requires basic grammatical knowledge. You got a subject, a verb, and an object. Is Jesus the subject of the verbs? Is he the one doing the action of the verbs? Now, if Jesus is mentioned and he is the subject of the verbs, part three of the diagnostic comes into play, and that is, what are those verbs? What is it the preacher is telling you Jesus has done, is doing, will do for you? Is this the Jesus who inspires you, who motivates you, who simply helps you, or is this the Jesus who lives for you, who suffers for you, who bleeds for you, who dies for you, and who rises again for you? When you're done with this diagnostic, what you've ended up with is a very, very basic way of figuring out whether you have heard a sermon that is both Christ-centered and cross-focused. Now, it doesn't answer every question that you should have for a sermon, but it does answer that basic question. Was this sermon about Jesus, and was this sermon about what Jesus has done for me in his perfect life, death, and resurrection? Now, when we come back from this break, we're going to start this sermon diagnostic. We'll be listening to Larry Rast's sermon that he gave on Matthew 24. We'll be stopping it occasionally and commenting, but I want you to listen for Jesus, listen to see if he is the subject of the verbs, and then what are those verbs? And then at the end, we'll step back and we'll ask this question. What has the preacher told us our problem is, and what solution has he offered to that problem? What solution does he give us? In other words, here I'm asking you to listen for law and for gospel. Our sermon review of Larry Rast's sermon coming up on Matthew 24 in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our audience in St. Louis can join in the conversation as well as our audience here in McPherson, Kansas. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Matthew 24, I'll read the text when we come back and we'll listen to Larry Rast's sermon.
Cross focus. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Are you looking for a helpful resource to teach your child or grandchild the basics of the Christian faith? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October is really a series of books called Follow and Do. These illustrated books cover the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Confession and Forgiveness. You can learn more about the Follow and Do series on our website. That's issuesetc.org. Or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. It's a catechism for young children with pictures. This series of six books costs $33.99 plus shipping and handling, or you can order the books individually for $6.99. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Follow and Do. It's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October. 1-800-325-3040. 325-3040. 3040.
Creation Evangelism from the Coffee Table.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the popular book on effective witnessing. It's called Why Won't They Listen? Well, Ken, this sounds like an intriguing idea, a coffee table used to spread the gospel. Tell us more about it.
I'd be happy to, Mark. We received a letter from a supporter in the Philippines telling us how much they enjoyed our creation books. They're using them with great success in their homeschooling. This man also gets great enjoyment over what we would call coffee table creation evangelism. The family actually keeps a number of our creation books on its coffee table. Visitors to their home can't help but see the books lying on the table, and they usually become the topic of conversation. The visitors then borrow the books to take home and read. In this way, the wonderful information concerning creation and the gospel is being passed on to others. This coffee table has actually become a lending library. It's so encouraging for us to see how others are helping to spread the word, especially since we at Answers in Genesis are unable to reach everyone ourselves with the message of Genesis and the gospel. Maybe you'd like to start a coffee table creation evangelism ministry in your home to spread the truths of Genesis.
One of our most effective witnessing tools is a free booklet on dinosaurs, written by Ken Ham. In fact, find out why Ken calls them missionary lizards. You can download this evangelistic booklet when you go to our website, answersradio.com. Answersradio.com.
Have you noticed how Sunday morning church has become more like the Oprah Winfrey Show? Pews filled with mostly women, music focused on subjective feelings rather than objective truths, preaching that sounds more like therapy than theology, and pastors who are afraid to take a stand. Is there still a place for real men in the church? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to visit Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, check out their website, www.ctsfw.edu, or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155. 800-481-2155. Real men attend Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. www.ctsfw.edu or 1-800-481-2155.
The 5th Annual Missouri Historical Society Trivia Challenge is Friday, October 14th at 7 p.m. at the Missouri History Museum, Linville and DeBolivar in Forest Park. Teams of 10 members will compete for the coveted title of Missouri Historical Society Trivia Champions, with prizes going to everyone on the first, second, and third place teams. Admission is $5 per person, $2 if you're a member. Missouri Historical Society Trivia Challenge tickets are on sale now at the Missouri History Museum. Visit mohistory.org for more information.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the last 25 minutes, our sermon review of Dr. Larry Rath's sermon on Matthew 24. Now, he preaches this sermon at the Chapel of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and that will account for some of the references he makes to seminarians and deaconess students and things like that. So just don't be distracted by that. Bear in mind. Now, his text comes from Matthew chapter 24, and he deals with two ends of a longer reading where Jesus says in verse 15, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down and take anything from his house." And then he also references the passage there, verse 22, "Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened, and if anyone says to you, 'Look, there is the Christ,' or 'There it is the Christ,' do not believe it." Let's see what Larry Rast does with Matthew 24. And remember, listen for Jesus. Is he the subject of the verbs, and what are those verbs?
No, seminarians and deaconess students, the abomination of desolation is not your study space as you roar out of control into these last weeks of the fall quarter, and as all things degenerate into chaos. No, pastors and organists, it is not the worship planning efforts for Advent that are already behind, and in some cases, not even started. No, professors, it is not the fact that you just gave the first exam of the quarter yesterday during the ninth week of a 10-week quarter. No doubt many of us are ready to flee to the hills at this muddled point in the church and academic years. It might be a relief to escape. But the abomination of desolation is none of these things. How do we know? Because a greater tribulation, even than these, is imminent. That's right. Things could easily get worse. As difficult as that is for us to understand, when we're in the midst of challenges and distressing events, the word of the Lord to us is that things could get, will get, worse. Our problem is that we think our problems are the worst problems that any human beings have ever faced. We are parochial beings. It is a basic human trait that we see our times and our circumstances as the most pressing, the most difficult times, things never seen before in the history of the church. This is the time we know, the only time we know, and no matter how much history we study, we remain chronologically and experientially detached from the events and incidents of those who have gone before us. In a sense, we cannot help but think that our time, our place, our experience is normative for all times and for all places. That's just the way it is. However, our inherent parochialism can lead to a kind of reversed triumphalism. That is to say, while it is sometimes easy for us to fall into a triumphalistic assertion that our synod, our congregation, our seminary is the best expression of Christianity ever in the history of the world, perhaps the only one, when things get tough, we can fall into another temptation. I'll call it catastrophism. The church has never experienced this kind of horror, plague, collapse, like we face now. This is it. The end is upon us. We must flee. Flee to the hills of Judea. Get out before it's too late, or you will all be destroyed. It is all too easy for us to conclude that our moment is the moment Jesus meant. Catastrophism is as dangerous as triumphalism. In both cases, we human beings set the terms of the debate. We ourselves define the boundaries and then make demands on how all should respond. And should others not respond how we insist they should, then they are rejecting the clear prophetic word. Again, the parameters of it are easily set. The proper response is the response I demand. Let's run out into the wilderness, because that's the only place where the Lord is to be found. He's no longer here with us. He's there, not here.
Now, I like Rast's insight here. In fact, I've been thinking a lot about this myself lately, this insight into kind of human pride. And what he's pointed out here in not so many words, and I wish he would just come out and say pride, hubris, because sins have names. But he's getting at it in the same direction. I just wish that one of my bones to pick with Larry's sermon here is that if you listen carefully, you can hear the law being very clearly proclaimed. That it is our pride that says these must be the best times the church has ever known, or these must be the worst times the church has ever known. But we're the ones who set the standard for best and worst, and we're the ones who judge all of history and the church by our own standard rather than Christ's. And then we require that everybody else kind of do what we think the times call for. Sins do have names, and I think he does mention pride here at some point, but there's no doubt the law is being preached. We got a problem, and that is, our problem is we think that our tribulation is the tribulation. And that really is a symptom of our pride. One more bone to pick, and that is, while we're listening for Jesus, so far he has been quoting from Jesus. Anybody can quote from Jesus. And he's been talking about what Jesus means, and anyone can do that. We'll have to listen further here to Dr. Rast's sermon to see if he gets to Jesus as the subject of those kind of verbs that Scripture uses with Jesus, like death and resurrection for sinners.
And there is anywhere but here. The Lord speaks. do not believe it. I have told you beforehand, these things will come to pass. And sure enough, for every generation, challenges and problems arise. The challenges are genuine, and they force us to come to grips with the evil that makes itself so evident in the world. But the Lord is here to comfort us. I have told you beforehand. So don't go running around desperately trying to save yourself. I've told you beforehand, so that when the issues arise and confront you, you can return to my unshakable word. I told you about the tribulation that will come so that you can stay focused on that which endures. After all, where do you see the abomination of desolation? What is that moment when all things come apart and despair and anguish are tangible and unmistakable? When is that great tribulation such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now? Matthew 27:46. My God, why have you forsaken me? At that moment, at that point, Christ, who became Maximus Peccator, the greatest sinner for us, carried all God's wrath. In the presence of the Holy God, he became the most abominable sinner in our place. But his death cut the days short. Were it not so, no human being could be saved. Because it is so, humankind is ransomed. If it were not for his great tribulation, we would despair, running about all the time, trying to find him, always chasing rumors. But now that the great tribulation is fulfilled, we flee to the mountains, indeed, to Judea's Mount Calvary, where he died in our place, clinging only to that. For us, the great tribulation, then, is no and never will be, for he has endured all things for us. He is the greatest sinner, so that you and I are the greatest saints.
Now, didn't take long for him to get to the cross, did it? We review a lot of sermons here on Issues, etc., from all over the place. We hear sermons from televangelists. We do sermons from local pastors sometimes. It's kind of an uneven field, but more often than not, the sermons we do from the people who are most acclaimed in the church for preaching, the people who have their own television shows, their own radio shows, and things like that, when they preach, it amazes me in almost every case how they can preach an entire sermon and not get to what it only took, 4 minutes for Larry to get to. A clear exposition of our sin, and then the answer to that sin, specifically, in terms that people can understand, in Jesus at the cross, dead for sinners. Did you hear it? He said the greatest tribulation that is yet to come is not the tribulation I've experienced, and I somehow, in my pride, have decided is the tribulation. The greatest tribulation that is yet to come, as Jesus speaks those words, and the abomination that makes desolation is Christ himself hanging dead on the cross, having borne the sins of sinners. Look at the verbs he used. I mean, he mentions Jesus, and these are the verbs. I wrote them down. I don't know if you were doing it as well. He spends some time talking about how Jesus has told us beforehand that the tribulation is coming, and Jesus comforts us that we know it's coming. We don't have to be surprised by it. And then he talks about Jesus carrying the wrath of God for us. He talks about Jesus becoming the greatest of sinners for us. And he's doing nothing other than quoting St. Paul. God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that in him we might be the righteousness of God. He became the greatest sinner that we might become the greatest saints in him. I think I'm just quoting Larry again. He talks about Jesus' death cutting the days short. Cutting the days of tribulation short because they finished the tribulation. See, I think the point of the sermon is that tribulation at the hand of God is not ours to suffer. It was Christ to suffer for us. And he did it. And the tribulation is finished. And now that the tribulation is finished, he says he fulfills the tribulation. We live now in our tribulations, our little small t tribulations, knowing that it's all over with. When Jesus says it's finished, he means it's really finished. Everything's finished. God's done what he planned to do. God doesn't have anything more to do except bring what has been finished to sinners. That's it. It's all done. I think that's the greatest good news we can hear. And he did it by simply mentioning Jesus and making Jesus the subject of all the verbs that Scripture uses for Jesus. It's not rocket science. Let's see how he concludes this sermon.
Where is Christ? Is he here in the wilderness or there in the inner rooms? How do we know? Look for signs and wonders? Our good and gracious Lord gives us the simple answer. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. He puts it this way two chapters later. Take, eat, this is my body. Wherever Christ is present, we who are dependent on him for life gather and feed upon him. And gathering in his name, he offers the feast of word and sacrament. We know he is here precisely where he has promised to be. Not over there, but in our midst. Not there he is, but here he is. In word, water, meal. For many of you, perhaps this quarter, this fall, this year, this life has been very difficult. Some of us who are in the academic cycle may find that in 12 to 15 weeks that this, in fact, was the easy quarter of this year. Who knows? What we do know, however, is that wherever the body is, there the eagles will gather. Christ remains present with his people. We gather around his body and blood and continue to feast on him. The cares of the world surround us and threaten to ensnare us. The word of the Lord is this: for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. They are indeed in Christ. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
All right, there's the sermon from Larry Rast. That's the least number of times, by the way, I've ever interrupted a sermon during one of my sermon reviews. Usually I have them hitting the button about every 15 seconds. But when someone's on a roll, you don't want to interrupt them, I think. I want you to notice what he did there, because he could have ended the sermon right where I stopped it last time. He could have ended it right there and just said, well, God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that in him we might be the righteousness of God. Jesus has borne our sins at the cross, and the tribulation is over. He fulfilled the tribulation, and anything that we suffer by way of small t tribulation is not the wrath of God. It cannot be the wrath of God, because all God's wrath is all spent out on Jesus. He's got no more wrath for sinners, because it's all been spent on Jesus. He could have ended it there. And that would have been a decent sermon. It wouldn't have been a Lutheran sermon. It wouldn't have been in the fullest sense, a scriptural sermon. Because of the question that is left hanging in the mind of the sinner at this point. So Jesus did this for me, and he did it all 2,000 years ago, and those words, "it is finished," were all uttered long ago. So what about me? I'm not standing under the cross having Jesus' blood sprinkled all over me. How does that blood, how does that death, how does that resurrection, where is it today? How does it get to me? Do I have to go back in my mind through prayer and meditation and somehow think about Jesus dying for me, and that's how it becomes mine? That's how it's made mine? Is it up to me to pray earnestly and envision in my mind Jesus dying for me, and then somehow I can experience what it is Jesus gave at the cross for me? Or, as so many Christians believe, does it get to me when I somehow say yes to it? It's just a proposition hanging out there in history, and it's just waiting for me to say, okay, and to sign on the dotted line. No. The answer that Scripture gives that to the question that Jesus asks, when people are saying, there he is, here he is, there's an answer to that question. If he's not there and he's not there, where is he? Where is Jesus for you? You know, we talk a lot about the omniscience of God and how Jesus and his omnipresence and his omnipotence. And if you ask Christians, you say, well, where's Jesus? They're going to give you one of two answers, both of which are right. One, they'll say, he's in heaven. That's true. And the other answer they'll give is, he's everywhere. Because after all, Jesus is God. And that's true as well. But have you ever thought about this? God being everywhere isn't necessarily good news. Have you read that psalm where the psalmist says, "Where can I flee to get away from your spirit? I could go up to the top of the mountain and you're there, and then I go down to the depths of the sea and you're there, and I take wing on the wings of the dawn and I go across the sea, and when I get there, you're waiting for me? Where can I go to get away from you?" he's asking. Just the fact that God is everywhere is not necessarily good news. In fact, for sinners apart from Christ, the fact that God is everywhere and you can't get away from him is bad news. Because apart from Christ, God is everywhere, but he's not for you. He's there in wrath. In the same sense that God is there in hell. He's in hell too. In wrath. So where is God for me in mercy? Where is he for me, a sinner? And we say, he's there at the cross for me. That's true. But the cross was 2,000 years ago. What do I got to do? Get on a plane, fly over to the Holy Land, search out and ask all the tour guides, where was the cross? Well, one guy says it's over here, and another guy says that for $25, he'll show me where it really was. And I can wander around just saying, was it here? Was it here? Like that guy in the cellular commercial. Jesus, can you hear me now? Can you still hear me? Can you hear me now? No, Jesus answers the question. And I love what Larry does with that. One of the most cryptic sayings Jesus ever uttered: where the body is, where the corpse is, the eagles will gather. And he interprets this in a thoroughly Christ-centered and cross-focused way. Where is Jesus? Jesus is in our midst. Jesus says, where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst of you. So what does it mean to be gathered in Jesus' name? Does it mean we just sit around and all say, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus? No. To be gathered in his name is to be gathered where he's promised to be. It's just like Mary coming to the tomb in that gospel account, where she goes and she doesn't find him. She goes to the tomb and he's not there. And the angel appears and says, he's not here. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth? He's not here anymore. He's risen. Now, go tell his disciples that where he's going to be for them, that he will go on ahead of them. It's just like that. We come. You can go to the tomb right now. We could get on a plane and go over there and see that tomb. Now, there are no angels there at the moment, but their words are still ringing. He's not here. Don't look for him here. Where is he? The answer is where he's promised to be, in his word and in his sacrament. That's where Jesus has promised to be. You want Jesus for you, that's where he's at. That's where you'll find him, where he's promised to be. That's what he means when he says, gathered in my name, there am I in your midst. And it's not just a spiritual presence. We gather at his table, and there he is in our midst, and at his table he feeds us with himself. He's there. In his body and in his blood, just as his word says. That's a question he's answering on the night before he's betrayed. He's telling his disciples, I'm going to the cross to give my life for sinners. And this is where you're going to find me from now on. Here it is, my body. Here it is, my blood. This is where you find me for the forgiveness of sins. This is where I am here for you. You know, I mentioned before when we were talking with the pastors in the round table, my 9-year-old son. He asks me on Saturday night, why do we have to go to church? And he got it right, partly. Why do we have to go to church to hear about how we're going to heaven? And I'm glad at least he got that. It really would have distressed me if he would have said, why do we have to go to church to hear about how we're supposed to live? He would have got a dope slap for that one. Not really. But he asks how we're going to heaven. And the answer I gave him, which was in a very clumsy fashion, much more eloquent here on the air, was simply this. Because that's where Jesus is for us. And we need Jesus. And we need him all the time. And that's where he's promised to be. We go there because that's where Jesus has said, I go ahead of you. Look for me. You'll find me. There I am for you, for sinners. Some of you may not know this, but on Reformation Day this year, 2005, Issues Etc., our nationally syndicated Sunday program, is going to celebrate its 10th anniversary with a banquet. Let's have a round of applause for 10 years. This man right here has been here for 10 years. I've only been here for 6. We'll be celebrating that 10th anniversary with a special banquet. We're kind of blowing out all the stops. And our guest speaker, our keynote speaker at that banquet, is going to be none other than Dr. Larry Rast, who you just heard preaching. It's going to be Saturday, November the 5th in St. Louis. If you want more information, you can contact Jenny Williams. Here's her number. She'll tell you all about it and get you signed up. 314-505-7836. 314-505-7836. That's Jenny's number. It's $50 a plate. I said we're pulling out all the stops. There are many Issues Etc. guests in attendance. We'll have them at the tables. Larry Rast will be there among many other of our guests as well. Now, we've only got room for 200 people, and I think we're about halfway to that goal right now with people who've already signed up for the banquet, and that means we've only got about 100 seats for that November 5th, Saturday evening celebration of 10 years of Issues Etc., the nationally syndicated Sunday night program. 314-505-7836. Ask for Jenny, and she'll tell you all about it. Before we go, also, another guest who'll be there that night, sitting at one of those tables, Pastor Matt Harrison, holds up an organization called LCMS World Relief. The need generated by Katrina and the other storms continues. It goes on, and it will for months and years. If you want to help Katrina victims and the victims of the other storms as well, call LCMS World Relief. There's a direct number for giving to Katrina victims. It's 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll see the logo for LCMS World Relief right there. Well, we're ending this first day of the Issues Etc. Reformation Tour at Grace Lutheran Church in McPherson, Kansas. A special thank to Pastor Dumperth for being our host, and also the congregation and everyone who came out today. Give yourselves a round of applause. Thank you for hosting our first day of the Issues Etc. Reformation Tour. We also want to thank Ron Peterman, who gave us help with the phones. He was back there fiddling with wires and making things actually occur, without which we would not have had a broadcast in St. Louis today. Tomorrow on the program, day two of the Issues Etc. Reformation Tour from St. John's Lutheran Church in Topeka, Kansas. We'll be making the trip up there tomorrow morning, getting ready to go. We'll be continuing our roundtable with pastors from that area on the Ten Commandments. We'll be doing Commandments 4 through 7 tomorrow in that ongoing conversation. And if all holds well, we'll have Senator Brown back as well. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.